Well, we're going to be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking, I'm afraid, with a New England Patriots fan. But I think even those of you that are Packers fans or Chicago Bears fans won't mind a bit, because we're talking about a really interesting book and an interesting story. The book is called Meeting Tom Brady, One Man's Quest for Truth, Enlightenment, and a Simple Game of Catch with the Patriots Quarterback. And the author of the book is Richard J. King, who teaches literature at Williams College in New England, and also the author of The Devil's Cormorant and Lobster. And he is responsible for this book, which is very much the story of his own ardent and very sincere desire to meet and interview and, yes, perhaps even play a game of catch with the NFL football superstar Tom Brady, of course, one of the finest quarterbacks ever to play the game, and beyond just a great quarterback, also an extraordinarily larger-than-life figure, a true celebrity in the world of professional sports, and also, of course, someone who's been in the news as of late for some rather unfortunate reasons, shall we say. It's a great story, and I'm excited to talk with the author, Richard J. King, about his book published by 4Edge. Richard J. King, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
One thing that leapt out at me as I read your book is the fact that after you've described your devotion to the New England Patriots and particularly your fascination with their quarterback, Tom Brady, at some point, you tell us that, in fact, you're not a lifelong Patriots fan at all, and have actually been enamored with other teams, including once upon a time one of my favorite teams, the Pittsburgh Steelers, back in their glory days. You say, I've always been a fair weather fan. Tell us more about that aspect of your interest in football, your fair weather fandom, so to speak.
Yeah. I grew up outside of Philadelphia. I was an Eagles fan and a Steelers fan. I grew up, in the 70s and early 80s when, the Steel Curtain and Mean Joe Green was my guy at the time. And I had, I still have my, Mean Joe Green cards. But a lot of the book is, and I think it's really for any football fans at all, and particularly for middle-aged guys, as we're sort of coming to grips with who we are and our levels of success. And I think a lot of us go to a game or to watch football to kind of feel good about the day and to sort of channel a little bit of our energies elsewhere. And so it has been hard for me to come to grips with the fact that, gosh, I've been in New England now almost 20 years. Would I be still a really devoted fan if the Patriots hadn't been so successful? And so I certainly can't claim to going back to the days when they were the Boston Patriots and they were really a doormat for the league. I'm hoping that, I can maintain and be a solid fan for the rest of for the rest of the Patriots' life.
In other words, if we could somehow turn back the clock and we were talking about the New England Patriots back in the Jim Plunkett era, back when he was their quarterback, he was talented, but the team really struggled, sometimes pathetically so. Chances are you would have had no affection whatsoever for the Patriots because they weren't winners.
Gosh, I hope not. I hope I would have been. I hope I would have been a bit more faithful. A lot of the book is really kind of thinking about what it means to be a fan and thinking about the contradictions we have all the time. And particularly now in the free agency era when, players come and go so quickly and you're really, as a lot of sports radio folks say, you're rooting for laundry, that you're just sort of rooting for the uniform. And that one of the things that's so compelling about Brady and, maybe same thing with Aaron Rodgers and other players that have been with the team for a long time, that there are really only two or three figures that really stay with the team for a long time in any given franchise.
Hmm. I thought it was interesting when you said that for as devoted as you are now to the New England Patriots and to Tom Brady in particular, you are not someone who would ever wear a Tom Brady jersey, you know, that one might buy in an apparel shop. You write at one point, I wore my Pat Patriot hat proudly, but I'm not at the jersey stage yet. I'd be too embarrassed walking around wearing a football jersey with a player's name on it, even at the game itself. This is partly because I would feel like too much of a spectator, which has a listless, passive, almost defeatist connotation for me. And then you go on to say, I know I'm well aware of the irony of this belief. I'm aware that within my mission to meet Tom Brady, I'm a hairball of hypocrisy. But wearing a jersey, if you're a guy, it practically says, I wish I were this man. I find that really, really interesting because you're probably not alone in that, but I'm impressed that you're as open as you are about those particular feelings.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is this sort of adventure, the whole starting in the spring of 2013, this sort of adventure and journey into what it means to be a football fan and a sports fan. And so a lot of that is talking to people and saying, you know, particularly men, you know, in their 30s and 40s saying, would I switch lives with Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers or any, you know, Jay Cutler if I could, you know, for a week or, you know, completely, as you're trying to sort of evaluate yourself and what you think is important. And there is something to, you know, and I don't want to insult any listeners of, you know, grown men walking around, you know, in football jerseys like we did when we were kids, but then at the same time, here I am spending a whole year and a half of my life, you know, trying to just have a catch with this one guy. So yeah, there's a lot of sort of working through some things, and hopefully in a funny comic way. I'm a cartoonist, and so part of the adventure was just drawing and sketching and meeting a whole bunch of people involved with being football fans.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Richard J. King, and his book is called Meeting Tom Brady, One Man's Quest for Truth, Enlightenment, and a Simple Game of Catch with the Patriots quarterback. And, of course, we're talking about one of the most famous quarterbacks, indeed one of the most famous players in the NFL, New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. One thing we should clarify is that as you got this idea that it would be so cool to talk with Tom Brady, that you yourself at the time were a writer, but you weren't a sports writer. So in a sense, from a professional point of view, you really had no business entertaining this notion as seriously as we might assume. Because, I mean, really, it's sports writers who, in a sense, have the right to ask for an interview with Tom Brady, and even a lot of them wouldn't necessarily be granted them. And so you really were, even as a writer, kind of an outsider from the outside, looking in and desperately wanting to gain entrance, in a sense.
Yeah. For me, that was very much a part of the adventure, is kind of finding what it was like to try to be a sports writer. And so one of my favorite days was when the press secretary at the Patriots allowed me to come to a press conference. And so I got up to, you know, he said, okay, go to booth 17 or 11, whatever it was. And I got there and he said, what media outlet are you for my, you know, security tag? And I said, I don't know what media outlet am I. I guess I'm the college where I teach. And so I wrote down the college where I teach, and I went through the security gate, and there I was, you know, at the field. And all I wanted to do was just sprint across the field and, you know, just do, you know, a 100-yard pretend kick return or something like that. But then I knew as soon as if I did anything like that, surely that would get on film, and then all of a sudden I'd never get this chance to have a genuine conversation with Tom Brady. So then I kind of got off the field and then went into the there was a little door that said press, and I opened that up, and then there I was, you know, with all these sports writers, a lot of them that I had seen on TV or read their columns and things, and trying to figure out how to behave in the press conference room. And then all of a sudden we were ushered into the locker room, and how was I to behave in the locker room? It was a fascinating day.
Mm. As you embarked on this, you were kind of in middle age. And you and your friend at one point, I can't remember his name. You really tell us his nickname. I can't think of it now, but it's a buddy of yours. And you are at one point in your conversation are kind of joking with each other about, you know, how's your midlife crisis going?
Right.
Say a word more about that, about this sort of quest, and how much that might have had to do with the fact that maybe to some extent you were perhaps experiencing what a lot of people would call maybe at least a mild case of a midlife crisis.
Yeah, that would be my oldest friend, Dump Truck, from Philadelphia.
Dump Truck, that's
yeah.
Right.
And we used to play one-on-one football growing up. You know, after we would watch NFL films for 3 hours, and you know, we'd tape up our hands and then go down and you know, basically tackle each other for all afternoon. Middle age was everything for this book, and that's part of my fascination with Brady. And so many people that I talked to were so fascinated with this idea about Brady, about sort of his confidence and his level of success. And as you know, probably for a lot of the listeners, when you arrive at a certain age, you're sort of assessed where you're at, and whether that's professionally or with your family, and trying to work through an acceptance that some of those ideas as you grew up that, hey, you know, if I just work really hard, I'm going to achieve everything that I want to achieve. And when you get older, you realize it doesn't always really work that way. There's luck, there's circumstances, or sometimes you really just don't have it, whether it's talent or whatever skills that you might not have. And so many people that I talked to were really fascinated with Brady's level of confidence. One of my favorite places actually was going to a Big Ten game at the Big House, and I had never experienced that. And you know, maybe a lot of listeners there have, you know, been to a Wisconsin game or to, you know, to a Big Ten game, and just to see all those fields of fans, and no one's been really talking about Michigan with the whole Deflategate summer, but there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of devoted Tom Brady Michigan fans, and they think about him, you know, as a Wolverine, and the stories that they tell about him at Michigan, and you know, the adversity he went through, and fighting for his job, and you know how well he did towards the end. It's a really interesting story, and so many of the people I talked to in those tailgating fields, you know, were middle-aged guys like me, and remembered watching Brady play at Michigan, and just talked about how he was Michigan for them. You know, the quarterback in the Big House, and the confidence he must have had, and how, you know, he just kept playing through adversity, and no matter what other people said about him, he just kept going.
Hmm. One of the most interesting moments in this quest for you early on, relatively early on, came when you got to actually speak with Tom Brady's backup, who actually had to go in for him for essentially an entire season when he went down with a very serious injury, from which he eventually recovered, of course, and eventually Matt Cassel moved on to another team. But Matt Cassel actually did stunningly well as Tom Brady's replacement. And you had the opportunity to actually speak with him in what had to sort of feel like a warm-up for the main event. Tell us a little bit about that encounter and how it happened.
Yeah. I mean, that, like you said, that started pretty early on in my adventure in the off season, or maybe around the summer, as moving up into training camp. And Matt Cassel was with the Vikings then, and I wrote to the Vikings and said, hey, is it possible to speak with Matt Cassel? And, you know, a couple days later, they said, sure. And there I was in my office, and on my phone it said, Minnesota Vikings. And, you know, the press guy came on, he said, hey, Matt Cassel's going to be on next. And then Matt Cassel came on, and I was talking to Matt Cassel, and he was a really nice guy, really warm, really great conversation, told all kinds of great stories, and I thought, gosh, maybe this actually isn't going to be that hard. Maybe a regular writer like me could talk to Tom Brady. And Matt Cassel told a lot of great stories, like you said, about that, you know, when Brady got injured that first game of, I think it was 2007 season, 2008 season, and, you know, what that was like all of a sudden when the doctor came up out after seeing Brady and realizing that Brady's season was over, and basically said to Matt, you know, like in the middle of the first quarter, hey, the rest of the season is yours. And what
Wow.
that would have been like for Matt Cassel. And he said that when he went onto the field for the first drive, all of the New England fans stood up and applauded, which was kind of was a really warm, exceptional response. And then he, you know, he was nervous for the first couple of plays, but then he threw a big bomb to Randy Moss, and then all of a sudden he loosened up. One great story Matt Cassel told that I didn't include in the book, but I think is a really intriguing one, is that when Matt Cassel first got to training camp with the Patriots, he was kind of looking at real estate one ads because he didn't really think he would make the team. And Brady walked over to him and said, you have to put that away. You know, if you're here, you got to be completely committed, 100%. And even if that story is sort of, I don't know, maybe it's been changed over the years or maybe it's a little bit trite, but I think it says a lot about, you know, where someone needs to be. And, you know, it's a good lesson for all of us to sort of focus on.
Absolutely.
What we're doing.
Absolutely. To have, I mean, and that's one of the reasons Tom Brady has achieved what he has, is that ferocious sense of focus which he has. One of the really interesting aspects of this book, in some ways it's the heart and soul of it, aside from just the striving to meet Tom Brady, is the way in which you encounter a wide array of really interesting Patriots fans. And, of course, to many of them, you pose the question of what would you ask Tom Brady? And you end up amassing a really interesting array of questions from a variety of fans. And I find that so interesting, although I can't even quite sort out in my mind exactly why all of that is so very compelling. But there's something about that. It says a lot about football fans, and it says a lot about who Tom Brady is, and about when we feel this devotion to someone. A lot can be read into those interesting questions.
Thanks. Yeah, no, I think so too. And I think a lot of those questions often just say a lot about who we are as people and what we're interested in. You know, so many people, I mean, we saw it this summer, just the amount of energy and attention and passion and vitriol over this Deflategate stuff when obviously there, you know, far more important things going on in the world. And yet it's just football and sport, it just gives us this opportunity to kind of unload and reflect back on ourselves. It was amazing when I set up these tables at South Station in Boston or at my local mall asking people what they wanted to ask Brady, or when I toured, you know, the tailgating fields outside the big house, you know, that when people were asking me to ask something for Tom Brady, they were really asking, you know, what were their concerns? You know, what did they really care about? And, you know, at a certain point, you could start to predict what people were going to say. You know, you could look at that person and say, oh, they're going to ask about the money, you know, or they're going to ask about the fashion, or they're going to ask about Brady's politics, or they're going to ask actually about something more technical with football. Or for my optometrist, she wanted to know, does he wear contacts? That's all I really want to know.
One of the things that I liked about your extensive descriptions of Tom Brady is the fact that there are all these ways in which he is this incredibly impressive celebrity. I mean, and, you know, exceptionally handsome and married to a bombshell wife, I mean, who is so gorgeous, and together they enjoy this life of celebrity. And yet there are all these different ways in which Tom Brady somehow also manages to shed that and seems like a good person. And you know, the kind of person that you just like, and the ways in which he is remarkably down to earth, for all of the ways in which his life is lived kind of up in the stratosphere. Can you just say a word about how he has managed to accomplish that? In some ways, that's as impressive as anything he's done on the football field.
Yeah, it really is extraordinary. And I like the author Charles Pierce talked about how the football player, you know, any, particularly the quarterback, is so much in the public eye, how much he's on television during a game. You know, they're even filming him, you know, when he's sitting on the sidelines. And that these guys aren't going into sports to be entertainers primarily. They're going to sports for the athletics. And yet there's so much that is put upon them as entertainers and speaking with the public. And, you know, even something like, if you're following the news yesterday, you know, Brady will say something about, you know, Donald Trump, and then all of a sudden this is, you know, Brady's official endorsement for who he thinks should be president. And you realize for someone like this that half of his life, starting in Michigan, he's been in the public eye and has had to watch every single thing that he says. And it's hard to imagine you know, it's almost like a Lady Di kind of thing. You think, like, gosh, the pressure that these folks are on to be in the media's eye for so long. And with Deflategate and, you know, people that would be incensed that Brady wouldn't know how to sort of speak to the press or that he would be telling a falsehood to the public, you know, someone like him, he's been telling falsehoods to the public since he got into the league. You know, every football player, when they get up on that stand, are basically told to, you know, just wax over, hey, how's your finger? Oh, it's fine, you know. So it's a very interesting thing. But after talking to so many people and so many sports writers, it's and seeing him in press conferences, he really does seem to be really good with the press. And he manages to not talk poorly about people and to at least present himself as a real team player. And, you know, none of us really know him. I don't know anything about him. But either he is really, really well coached at working with the press, or he genuinely is a really good guy and tries to be a team player and works hard not to, to speak ill of anybody.
Hmm. Well, as our listeners have probably gathered by now, we are on purpose not revealing how all of this ends at your request. So people need to read the book in order to hear how your quest to finally meet and interview and maybe even toss a football around with Tom Brady, how that quest ultimately ends. The book is also, to a large extent, about you becoming enamored with the game of football again after some years away. And you said that maybe it had something to do with turning 40 and becoming a father. Perhaps it's psychological, perhaps it's chemical. Have you yet figured out the answer to that question of why you got, found yourself drawn back to football so forcefully?
Yeah, I mean, I think if we try to identify what is our most masculine sport, you know, in the U.S., I think most people would agree that it's football in terms of at least the major ones. And, yeah, I think there was a certain element of me of, you know, kind of walking around with my daughter, who is amazing, you know, it, in the baby Bjorn, and, you know, just sort of feeling I wasn't quite, you know, the man that, you know, and I'm a literature professor. I, you know, what do I do at the end of a day? I send a lot of emails, I grade papers, I read books. You know, I would like to be working more with my hands and accomplishing more at the end of a day. And so it was a lot of thinking about, like, about masculinity in general. And here is, you know, Brady in so many ways is such like the alpha gorilla, you know. I mean, he is, you know, accomplished so much in one of the most masculine environments out there.
Hmm. Well, the book is just terrific. Again, it's called Meeting Tom Brady, One Man's Quest for Truth, Enlightenment, and a Simple Game of Catch with the Patriots Quarterback, published by 4Edge, and the author, Richard J. King. Richard King, congrats on a great book, and thank you for making time for this interview. It was fun to talk with you. Best wishes.
Oh, so nice of you to have me on, Greg.
All right, there we go, with a minute to spare.
Thanks a lot. That was a really nice interview. I appreciate it.
Good. Glad you enjoyed it. I enjoyed the book a lot. All right, best wishes to you.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. Bye-bye. In this portion of the morning show, we're going to be looking back at the single game which transformed NFL football here in America more than any other game. We're talking about the championship game played back in 1958 between the Baltimore Colts and the New York Giants. It was a game which was nationally televised, and it helped bring NFL football a front and center into American cultural life. Mark Bowden, a highly regarded author of a number of different bestsellers, wrote a book several years ago about this important game and this seminal moment in NFL history. That book is titled The Best Game Ever, Giants vs. Colts, 1958, and the Birth of the Modern NFL. I wonder, ahead of you beginning work on this, how much did you know about this game, and what in particular drew you to it as the subject for a new book?
Well, I knew of the game. It obviously is one of the most famous in NFL history, and I grew up the latter part of my childhood in Baltimore, so I knew this team, and of course I heard a lot about this game. I was a little too young to have seen it myself, so I was always interested in it. The idea of writing this book was actually proposed to me by my publisher, Morgan Entrekin, several years ago after I had finished writing Guests of the Ayatollah. he knew that I was a football fan. I'd written a book some years ago about the Philadelphia Eagles in 1992 called Bringing the Heat. I was a football writer for a brief period in my experience as a newspaper reporter. So this was an opportunity to return both to a subject matter that interested me and also a piece of my own past.
It's intriguing to write about something which is 50 years in the past, unlike, for instance, Guests of the Ayatollah, the Iranian hostage crisis, which is about half as many years in our past as this football game. As you sought to connect with some of the principal players, I'm using that term in a couple of different ways, of course, who were part of this game, it had to be frustrating to know that some of them were already gone.
It's true. You know, but I think roughly half of the men who played in this game are still around, and I was able to track down most of them. I was frankly surprised and delighted that so many of them were still around, and they were, you know, extremely helpful. But it is true that my work does seem to be regressing deeper and deeper into the past. And as you move further back into the past, obviously you, by necessity, have to rely more and more on documentary evidence and the record. So I get a great deal of pleasure out of researching old newspaper files and looking for artifacts like, say, the audio recording of the NBC broadcast of this football game. And it's really, it's a little bit like a treasure hunt. You go off in search of documentation for the thing that you're going to write about, and every once in a while you really strike gold.
I think I've touched on the fact that this game was nationally telecast, but you tell us, or at least imply, that absolutely nothing of this game survives in terms of any footage from that telecast.
That's right. There's no footage of the actual television broadcast, but there are a smattering of films of the game. NFL Films made a documentary 25 years ago about this game, which has some really terrific black and white footage shot on the sidelines. It was not from the television broadcast. It was from someone operating a camera on the sidelines, even though NFL Films didn't exist in 1958. And then there was, of course, what's called the coaches' film, which is NFL teams all utilize film to study their opponents and to prepare for their next football game. And so this game, like every game, was filmed from a vantage point high over the 50-yard line where you can see all of the players on the field, virtually the entire field. It's very useful for study purposes. It's nothing at all like or nearly as exciting as the footage that you watch on a television broadcast. But for coaches who are looking to study plays and formations and strategy, the coach's film is actually a more useful tool.
So how much of this game exists on film? I mean, even if it is from a kind of a distant, frustrating vantage point, as you just described, I mean, do we have all or nearly all or a substantial portion of this game on film?
The entire game is on film.
Really?
And I was very fortunate to recruit the help of Philadelphia Eagles head coach Andy Reid, who, out of the goodness of his heart and out of his own curiosity, sat with me for hours dissecting that coach's film, which is, of course, what he does for a living. And his insights into the strategies of the teams, the formations, the abilities of the players was invaluable to me and really informed my analysis of the whole game in the book.
You mentioned the fact that the radio broadcast, I think you said, over NBC also exists, and indeed that broadcast is quoted throughout the course of your book, including once in a while interesting mistakes, as sometimes occur in live broadcast.
That's right. You know, I used the radio broadcast to try to capture some of the excitement and immediacy of the game. We're all used to watching football games with commentary. It's just part of the experience. And so to have that instant explanation and reaction on a recording was invaluable to me, I think, in trying to capture the atmosphere. And yes, that does occasionally come with the mistakes that broadcasters make, having to, you know, unravel a complicated, fast-moving game very quickly.
I wanted to mention one other thing that you mentioned very much in passing in the introduction. You called this game between the Giants in their dark blue helmets and the single red stripe and blue wool jersey and the white numbers, and the Baltimore Colts with the horseshoe emblem on their white helmets and badly soiled whites with blue numbers and trim. You called this a colorful spectacle for those present, but for the far bigger part of its audience, the most celebrated game in football history would be remembered primarily in black and white. And I think that's so interesting, because even if all we've ever seen is are still photos of this game, I've only seen photographs of this game in black and white, and it never really stopped. I never stopped to think about how I only think of this in black and white. And
right.
It's interesting how that changes our view of it, and in some ways even heightens our sense of the drama that played out that day stretching into the evening.
It's true, and there's a reason why Hollywood filmmakers really enjoyed and exploited the shadows and light in for the monochrome of black and white film to make these wonderful film noir classics. And it isn't just the fact that this game was seen primarily in black and white, because black and white was the only kind of televisions around in 1958 for the most part. But the fact that the game was played late in the afternoon and spilled over into the evening, into night, and the lighting in Yankee Stadium, where night games were not as common as they are today, was not as effective as it is. If you go to a night game, football or baseball today, the whole arena is illuminated like it's noon. But back in 1958, the lights were very adequate for lighting up the field, but they didn't light up the stands. And so what that meant when you looked at this black and white picture on your television was you had a brightly illuminated field of play and a stark black backdrop, as though someone had just lowered a black curtain, which I think made the action appear all that more dramatic and memorable.
You say many of the viewers, meaning now the viewers of the telecast, just beginning to tune in, were not regular watchers of pro football, and they were seeing something starkly different than the traditional college games played on sunny autumn afternoons. This was more like mortal combat from some dark underworld. As in some medieval rite, the players on both sidelines were draped in long capes. A master cinematographer could not have lit the scene more dramatically. We're speaking with Mark Bowden about his wonderful book called The Best Game Ever, which is a look at the NFL championship game of 1958. Just ahead of us talking specifically about the game, I want to return to the matter of your encounters with many of the principal players involved in this game, literally some of the players on the field and also others who were important participants. You tell us at one point in the book that one of the most extraordinary things about this game is that when you consider the players on the field and the coaches on the sideline and how many future members of the NFL Hall of Fame were on the field or in that stadium, it truly is a constellation of incredible greatness playing out here.
It's true. There were 17 future members of the Hall of Fame, and it was certainly the greatest assembly of talent ever in a professional football game. And what's more interesting about it, even just than the fact that all these great players and coaches and owners were there, but that the reason that so many of these players and coaches went on to the Hall of Fame is that they were really at the vanguard of the evolution of the game of pro football. So, for instance, you had as the two assistant coaches for the New York Giants, Vince Lombardi on the offense and Tom Landry coaching the defense. Well, they were young coaches then. They had yet to develop their own style. And, of course, Lombardi went off to Green Bay and created the great dynasty of the Green Bay Packers. And Landry went off to Dallas to create his own dynasty there. The reason that they went on to such heights is that they were innovators who were stretching the strategies and tactics of football in new directions. And, you know, the success that they would have later on is just testament to how innovative they were. And a lot of those the budding approaches that they were taking are visible in this game.
You mentioned the fact that about half of these players are still alive, and many of them you were able to speak to. And that's, of course, one of the things that enriches this book immeasurably. I wonder, sometimes as people look back on events from 50 years before, the memories are clouded, or perhaps they see things very much from their own perspective and not that of others. Can you give us any general reaction to the experience of speaking with these men about this big day from so much earlier in their lives, the clarity of their recollection, and maybe the wisdom with which they were able to look at these events now?
You know, it varied greatly, and it's really interesting to see how. I mean, on the one hand, on one extreme, you had Raymond Berry, who is a very cerebral football player and coach, and who's someone who kept meticulous notes, which he prepared actually before the game, and has sort of made a study of football all of his life. He remembers this football game from 50 years ago as though he played it yesterday. And he has the advantage of all of his notes to jog his memory. On the other extreme, you have a wonderful character like Fatso, Artie Donovan, who has been dining out on his wit and his humorous anecdotes about his days as a pro football player for a half century. And his memories of this game are rich and colorful, but are not always exactly true. You want to tell Artie's stories the way he tells them, though, just because they're so artfully and comically prepared. But you have to go back to the record to make sure that Artie remembers things exactly. Some guys, like Ordell Bracy, a really bright guy, has nevertheless misremembered certain key aspects of the game and has no doubt remembered them incorrectly for so long now that they are just, you know, they've become his memory. But the film of the game and the radio broadcasts contradict him in certain key areas. So it is really interesting.
You, of course, were too late to be speaking directly to, for instance, the Colts quarterback Johnny Unitas, who passed away several years ago. And of course, there are a number of players who are now gone. But of course, you also had a rich legacy of all the interviews which many of these important players did.
Right.
And over again, of course, this would be a game they would be asked about repeatedly.
Yep. And it's almost always the case when I write a book or a story about something that includes, you know, certain very famous people. If I can't have access to those people, either because they refuse to be interviewed or they've deceased, generally they're the least significant people for me to not be able to meet personally, because, as you say, they've been interviewed so many times in the past. So Johnny Unitas's recollections of this game have been written about and analyzed and pored over for a half century, whereas somebody like Al Berry, who played offensive line for the New York Giants, I doubt that, you know, more than two or three people have ever interviewed Al at any length about his memories of the game. So he was more valuable, frankly, to me.
One person that I wish you had come along soon enough to interview would be Alan Ameche. And I say that because for the many listeners to this program who are from Kenosha, Wisconsin, they would have, of course, dearly loved to have heard even more about this great running back. Of course, you talk about him in the pages of your book, and he is one very colorful character indeed in this drama.
Mm-hmm. Well, he is, and he, you know, a great lover of opera, which was a sort of an unusual taste for a football player, a really bright guy who, in addition to his athletic ability, proved to be an extraordinarily astute businessman and investor who made millions when he left football. I think one of the revelations in this book about Alan Ameche, which I've never seen reported anywhere else, is how disgruntled he was playing for Weeb Eubank, his head coach. Eubank, who used a method of motivation for some players who he didn't particularly like, which he called needling, began needling poor Alan Ameche right after he joined the football team. And Ameche cut his career fairly short. He only played for 6 years, even though he was a tremendous success in pro football. And a lot of people have wondered why he bowed out quite so early. And one of the reasons was that he did not like playing for Weeb Eubank. And, of course, at the time, it wasn't very easy for players to change teams. Hmm.
Let's talk about 1958 and what made this such an important time for the game of football. You say in 1958, professional football, the league and its audience, were on the cusp of an explosion. Tell us the state of affairs leading up to 1958. What was professional football like in this era, and how was it perceived? So we can better understand then the catalyst of change that this game in 1958 proved to be.
Well, of course, pro football had been around for about 30 years and had been growing in popularity throughout the 20th century. It was really the advent of television and the sort of merger of television and football, which occurred most dramatically in this game, that launched pro football. But basically, prior to the sort of the boom years of the 1950s, baseball was the only really major sport in America. It was the national pastime, and it really dominated the leisure time and interests of the American people. But as the wealth of our society grew and people had more and more leisure time, there was a great deal of interest, growing interest in sports as both a recreational activity and as something to watch. And this, of course, this growth in leisure time and interest in sports was happening at the same time that television was maturing and every household in America was getting a television set. So what was about to happen was the sort of explosion, not just of football, but of really sports in general. I mean, you have the creation of professional hockey leagues and basketball. And, of course, today, you know, there's many more sports that occupy America's interest. Of all these, football is the most successful and is the one that has best exploited television. And I think it's because, you know, football is an ideal sport for a television broadcast.
I would like you to explain that just a little bit further. You talk about the game's inherent appeal and what you call its neat fit with TV, and that you put those two things together and pro football and the public were just bound to fall in love with one another. And of course, 1958 is the moment that happens. Just explain for a moment why football is such a perfect fit with television. What is it exactly about the game?
Well, George Will sort of famously and disparagingly described football as combining two of the worst aspects of American culture, violence and punctuated by committee meetings. And that is true. But the reason that those things are so popular in America is because they're fascinating. You know, football game takes place on a big field, but before every play, all of the players huddle. They decide what they're going to do next, which builds suspense. And then they all line up in a very compact formation, which fits fairly neatly within the binds of a television set. And on the snap of the ball, they execute this play, which takes place over, you know, rapidly, very fast. There are a lot of players and 22 players in motion. And frankly, it's pretty difficult for someone sitting in the stands of a football game to fully understand what has just happened on any given play. With football, because there's this delay between plays, it gives television nowadays, especially with the tools of slow motion replay and isolated cameras, and of course the commentary of expert football watchers, in the period between plays, you know, we basically what happens is television sorts out the action for us. It isolates the key players. Sometimes nowadays, the analysts will actually draw up on a telestrator on your screen exactly what routes players ran. So the game, as the game is being played, television is explicating it for the audience, which of course builds understanding and enhances, I think, the experience of the game. So for all those reasons, you know, television is just an ideal vehicle for the game of football.
Best-selling author Mark Bowden's book is called The Best Game Ever, Giants vs. Colts 1958 and the Birth of the Modern NFL, published by Grove Press.